Last time I spoke, I stood down there and used the slides. And I used those slides to show the three journeys of Paul through Asia Minor and Greece, and then his subsequent imprisonment in Caesarea, and then they moved him to Rome, and then his letters from Rome back to his churches. And we've looked at those letters from my perspective, the point I wanted to make from those letters. We've looked at those letters already. Upon his release from prison in Rome, Paul then travels with several members of his evangelistic, I would call it an evangelistic team. They are out to preach the gospel. And he has a team of people, and they travel, including Luke and Tychicus and Titus and Timothy and others. He leaves Titus in Crete, and then he leaves Timothy in Ephesus. And Paul himself travels on to Macedonia. And from there he writes back the two letters that I want to address today. Probably wrote Titus first, I'm just guessing, since he dropped off Titus first, and then he writes 1 Timothy to Timothy back in Ephesus. And I want to identify today specifically what the problem was. And there was a problem in both of those places, and it's quite clear in 1 Timothy and Titus. I'd like to address again to identify the characteristics of that problem in those two letters. As I said, Paul probably sailed to Crete first and then to Ephesus because Crete is on the way to Ephesus. But the letter to Titus is kind of without any background. We don't know anything about the church in Crete except from what's written in that letter. So I don't want to start there. I'll start with Timothy because we know the background of the problem in Ephesus. So I'm going to turn to 1 Timothy and go through some clues here to the problem that was being addressed. 1 Timothy 1, starting in verse 3. I besought you, Timothy, Paul writing to him, I besought you, Timothy, to abide still at Ephesus when I went into Macedonia, that's where Paul is writing from, in Macedonia, that you might charge some that they teach no other doctrine. Now, why did Paul leave Timothy there in Ephesus? We know from 2 Timothy that some in Ephesus, Paul puts it, greatly withstood him, and many in Asia turned away from him, according to what he writes in 2 Timothy. I won't turn there now. But it seems that Paul may have suffered extreme persecution there in Ephesus, maybe even life-threatening persecution from the Jews there, and it might have been stirred up. He might have been betrayed by members of the church in Ephesus. That's just speculation. But he seems to have fled, even fled for his life, from Ephesus when he left Timothy there. He left Timothy there to deal with a problem. And Paul had used Timothy that way before. If you remember, with the problem in Corinth, Paul sent Timothy to deal with the problem in Corinth first. And now, again, Timothy is the trusted troubleshooter for Paul, and he's left at Ephesus to handle this problem. He's not there as the pastor. He's not a pastor in the modern sense of the word pastor. That was not Paul's pattern. Paul ordained elders in every congregation. And we know from Acts chapter 20 that there were already elders ordained and taking care of the church in Ephesus. But he leaves Timothy there because some have turned against Paul. And Timothy is there to straighten out a leadership crisis. Again, both Timothy and Titus were part of Paul's evangelistic team, you might say, ministers. But not ministers to a single congregation. They were part of his team. And Paul will recall both Timothy and Titus to himself after their troubleshooting work is done. So my point here in this little aside is that these letters are written to aid his troubleshooters, Timothy and Titus, against the problems that are occurring in those churches. But what was the problem? Verse 3 says that they teach no other doctrine. So I'd like to number these clues, and this would be number one. The number one clue is another doctrine. You know, whatever was troubling the church was coming from inside the church. Now, just as in Corinth, just as in Galatia, the heresy is inside the church. It's not a problem from Jewish persecutors. There are Jewish persecutors of the church, indeed, but that's not what the problem is. That only binds the church together more strongly. It's men who claim to be Christians, but theirs is a reinterpretation of Paul's gospel. Verse 4 says, "Neither give heed to fables and endless genealogies which minister questions." This, I would say, is number two, clue number two. Fables and endless genealogies. What is he talking about? Now, it's widely understood that part of the problem, at least part of the problem in Ephesus, is Gnosticism. This is no great revelation. Every commentator will tell you at least part of the problem is Gnosticism. Gnosticism fits this characteristic of fables and endless genealogy. The Gnostic system is based upon a creation story. Well, practically every religion, everybody's worldview is based upon a creation story. It all goes back to how things started. You know, where did we come from? Everybody's belief system goes back to that. And Genesis, of course, is the Jewish creation story. The Gnostics seem to have been Jewish intellectuals who invented a story behind the story of Genesis 1, a story which came before Genesis 1. And the motivation for that story seems to be that God, the God of the Old Testament, has not blessed Abraham and his descendants. He has not fulfilled his promises to them. They have not become a great nation. They're a backwater of the Roman Empire. Why? And their set explanation seems to be that the God of the Old Testament was not, turns out he is not the highest God. He couldn't fulfill the promises because he doesn't have that power. He is ignorant of the highest God. He wants to be worshipped as God, but he is not the highest God. Sound like a fable? Well, it certainly is a fable. It's based solely on speculation. Paul's letter to Titus, which we'll look at a little later, adds the detail saying these are Jewish fables. Jewish fables. So indeed, these are speculations about the Bible, but what happened before the Bible, going backwards in time from Genesis 1. Now there's an example. I'd like to quote a few examples from a book from the Gnostics themselves. It's called The Secret Book According to John. This is one of the 13 Gnostic books that were discovered in 1945. They were dug up in Nag Hammadi in Egypt. Exactly how old the origin of those books is not known. They were probably buried in Egypt back in the imperial churches, you know, the Roman church's persecution of the Gnostics back in the 300s. The books were written in Coptic. Coptic is the descendant of the old ancient Egyptian language, but they were probably written originally in the Coptic. They were originally written in Greek and then translated to Coptic by Gnostic believers. Some of them may have been composed before the time of Christ. Obviously, the one called The Secret Book According to John was not that old, because the author tries to attribute it to the Apostle John. It's probably written early in the second century, but it contains an example of a Gnostic creation story. Creation story. This is a typical creation story of the second century Gnostics, and it may be as old as the first century B.C., and I think you would call these Jewish fables, similar to the pre-Christian Jewish fables of Alexandria, Philo, and such. And they reinterpret the story of Genesis in terms of their own understanding, their own interpretation. Okay, so the Secret Book of John quotes the highest God, the very highest God, saying this, "It is I who am with you always. It is I who am the Father. It is I who am the mother. It is I who am the son." And the book goes on elsewhere to say, the unit or the monad, the unit, that's the primary unit, the highest God, since it is a unitary principle of rule, has nothing that presides over it. This is the highest God in their fable. And then this first principle generates the next. And its thinking, the highest one's thinking, produced the Barbilo, the most perfect glory among the eons. So the Barbilo is the second principle. Remember these names now, because there'll be a test later on, but you understand the genealogies here. The Barbilo produces four luminaries, which are angels: Harmozel, Oroiel, Deoithai, and Eleth. I won't spell them. The luminaries, in turn, the four luminaries produce 12 eons, and the last and the lowest of the eons is named Sophia. And the Sophia produces Ieltabaoth. Now, Ieltabaoth is imperfect. Ieltabaoth is the creator of all physical things. He is, they would say, the God of the Old Testament. Now we come to Genesis 1, the Ieltabaoth. This is the physical creation or the realm of darkness. The book says, "And seeing the creation surrounding it," it being the Ieltabaoth, "and the multitude of angels around it that had come to exist out of it," out of the Ieltabaoth, "it said to them, 'For my part, I am a jealous God, and there is no other God apart from me.'" Right? This is the claim of the God of the Old Testament. But it's actually this Ieltabaoth. The Ieltabaoth produces 12 authorities. Remember these: Athoth, Harmas, Khalil, Omri, Iabel, Adonias, Cain, Abel, Abrisin, Iobel, Armopiel, Melchior, Adonine, and Belias. And the Ieltabaoth established 7 kings in charge of the 7 heavens. This is all in the dark realm now, the physical creation. There are 7 heavens in the dark realm. So altogether now, the authorities, the rulers, the powers, and the angels number 365. It's kind of convenient for astrology purposes. 365 angels, each named in this book as they help the Ieltabaoth create Adam. And the numbers of the angels vary according to the various Gnostic authors. You expect variation since it's all made up to begin with. So Paul speaks in verse 4 of endless genealogies. And here I think we have close enough to endless genealogies in the principalities and powers over the earth. And I'm not sure that that was particularly the genealogies that he's thinking of, because there's also a Gnostic concept of all spiritual people having been descended from Seth, but all unspiritual people having been descended from Cain. And so you want to be able to trace your genealogy back to Seth. But I think probably what Paul had in mind here was the many names of the angels and the powers above. Notice again that this is Jewish speculation. And it's about Genesis. The pagans don't care about Genesis. It's about angels. Pagans don't know anything or care anything about angels. There are no angels in pagan religion. This is Jewish. Although I'll hasten to add that it is anti-Jewish Jews. It is anti-Judaism Jewishness, because it denies that the God of the Jews is the true God. They instead are trying to harmonize the myths of the much-admired Greek world with the Old Testament. Verse 5. "Now the end of the commandment is charity out of a pure heart and of a good conscience and of faith unfeigned." Verse 6. "From which some having swerved have turned aside unto vain jangling." That's clue number 3. Vain jangling. Vain not meaning proud or arrogant, but vain meaning empty or foolish, fruitless discussions. These speculations try to harmonize the Bible with Greek mythology, in the sense that they believe that the Greeks probably borrowed their theology from the Bible, that the Bible predated it. The Bible was right all along. You just have to interpret it differently. You know, to read between the lines in the Bible, and their reading between the lines is what Paul, I think, would call vain jangling. Meaningless, fruitless. Verse 7, desiring to be teachers of the law, understanding neither what they say nor whereof they affirm. That's clue number 4. Teachers of the law. Well, Genesis is the first book of the law, but I don't think the Gnostic reinterpretation of history is what they don't understand. What they don't understand about the law, it seems to me, is some obscure meanings to the ceremonial law, the reinterpreting of the rituals of the tabernacle, the rituals of the Old Testament. Remember back in Colossians 2:16, it sort of implies that they advocated parts of the rituals of holy days, new moons, and Sabbaths. And a lot of the book of Hebrews implies that they had alternate interpretations of the rituals of the tabernacle. A lot of Hebrews about the tabernacle. Exactly what their reinterpretation was and what their imitation of those rituals was, I don't have a clue. But we know that the Gnostics denied the humanity of Christ. They denied his literal death as a sacrifice. And so they missed the whole point of the ritual law, the sacrificial law, and how it's replaced by Christ's bodily sacrifice. So this could be the understanding neither what they say nor whereof they affirm. They are mixing in Old Testament ritual with their understanding of their Gnostic myth. I'm just looking for clues here about the characteristics of the opposition in Ephesus, so let's skip to verse 18. This charge I commit to you, son Timothy, etc., war, good warfare. Verse 19, let's skip to 19. Holding faith and a good conscience, which some, having put away concerning faith, have made shipwreck. Now, some have dropped the understanding that Paul had preached to them in Ephesus in favor of some alternate system. They have rejected the faith. Verse 19 doesn't say the faith. It says concerning faith, but the NET Bible and the NIV have it translated differently, which some have rejected and so have suffered shipwreck in regard to the faith. You know, the faith is the holding of the true doctrine. It is the true religion. It is the doctrine that Paul taught them to obey. And they have abandoned that religion for the Gnostic story. They profess to worship Christ, but they deny who he was and what he taught, effectively. Of whom, an example, he says in verse 20, of example is Hymenaeus and Alexander, whom I have delivered unto Satan, that they may learn not to blaspheme. So this, I would say, is the fifth clue, number 5. Some teacher, false teacher examples, Hymenaeus and Alexander. Paul says they blaspheme. Well, I would say if you say that the God of the Old Testament is not the true God, that's pretty close to blasphemy. It is a characteristic of which Gnosticism qualifies. Hymenaeus specifically is mentioned again in 2 Timothy. I won't turn away from 1 Timothy here, but I'll read you a few verses. 2 Timothy 2:16 through 18 says, "Shun profane and vain babbling." It sounds like he's talking about the same kind of thing. "For they will increase into more ungodliness." And he says, "Their word will eat as does a canker, of whom is Hymenaeus and Philetus." So he's mentioned again. Verse 2:18 in 2 Timothy says, "Who concerning the faith have erred, saying that the resurrection is past already, and overthrow the faith of some." And this is nearly the same doctrine that we read of in 1 Corinthians. When the problem was in Corinth, Paul wrote, "How say some among you that there's no resurrection of the dead?" Okay, Hymenaeus is connected with that same doctrine. And it ties together also the ideas of vain babblings and an alternate understanding of the resurrection. It's all one package, one problem. And then there's another teacher mentioned here in verse 20. It's Alexander. Alexander also gets a mention in 2 Timothy. 2 Timothy, Paul wrote that Alexander the coppersmith did me much evil. Well, it's probably the same man. We don't know for sure. But the name Alexander appears in Acts chapter 19 when they had that riot in Ephesus and they assembled a big crowd in the theater. It says in Acts 19:33, they drew Alexander out of the multitude, the Jews putting him forward. Could be the same person, probably is. I'm getting extreme coincidence if it wasn't the same person. So I'm thinking that probably Alexander was an early believer in Ephesus. He was there from the beginning of Paul's ministry in Ephesus, who later turned to follow a Gnostic teacher. And this might explain why he was influential. He was a longtime member, as long as they had been. They've only been there 7-8 years. But he was one of the early members in Ephesus. He could then do Paul much harm in Ephesus, which Paul writes of in 2 Timothy. And in fact, both of these men, if they go back to the beginning of Paul's ministry in Ephesus, they could have been elders. And that would explain why it is that in 1 Timothy and Titus, Paul is explaining how to ordain elders and deacons, because they need to replace some. They've lost some. Let's turn to chapter 4 for another clue here about what Timothy is facing in Ephesus. 4 verse 1, "Now the Spirit speaks expressly that in the latter times some will depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of devils." This I'll number as number 6, seducing spirits. Seducing spirits, well, Gnosticism is an attempt at spirituality. Just say that much. Influence of wrong spirits. Gnosticism is all about trying to experience the spiritual. Now, is he talking about what's going on in Ephesus, or is he talking about the end times? He says, in the latter times. Is this a prophecy for our time, or is this referring to what's going on in Ephesus? I think it's referring to what's going on in Ephesus, because at that time, they considered themselves in the latter times. They expected Christ to return soon. So he's saying that these things are to, these troubles in Ephesus are to be expected, because we expected that in the latter times these things will occur. Paul, in fact, had predicted these problems himself. If you remember, the last time he was in Ephesus was at the end of his third trip. He went there and called the elders together in Acts chapter 20, verse 29, and said, "I know this, that after my departing will grievous wolves enter in among you, not sparing the flock." So he predicted this. Verse 30, "Also of your own selves will men arise." And he was speaking to the elders in Ephesus, speaking perverse things to draw away disciples after them. So this is why Luke recorded that warning, I think, for us in Acts. The wolves are the current teachers in Ephesus. And they have come as he predicted. And verse 2 says, "Speaking lies in hypocrisy, having their conscience seared with a hot iron." And certainly their preaching of these fables apparently didn't affect their conscience. And they apparently felt no shame for the bad behavior and the immorality that their doctrines produced. And verse 3 says, "Forbidding to marry and commanding to abstain from meats, which God created to be received with thanksgiving." So I take this as a clue number 7, marriage and meats, or prohibition of marriage and meats. Some teachers of Gnosticism indeed were known to disapprove of marriage and of eating meat. In the 2nd century, Irenaeus wrote of a teacher called Saturninus of Antioch. Irenaeus wrote of Saturninus, and he says that marriage and engendering of offspring are from Satan. And most of his followers abstain from the flesh of living things, and they deceive many people by this feigned abstinence. They're trying to appear spiritual. Some commentators, of course, will try to connect these comments about marriage and about meat to the human traditions of the Jewish faith, to the Talmud. But those kinds of denunciations that we're seeing here do not apply to Judaism. They do not apply at all to Judaism. I see no reason to believe that there are two separate problems in Ephesus. Verse 7, "But refuse profane and old wives' fables, and exercise yourself rather unto godliness." Is he speaking of Judaism? I don't think so. This is a re-emphasis of the clue number two above, about fables and endless genealogies. Old wives here is kind of a funny word. It's a Greek word, graiotes. It means crone-like or silly. It just means silly. It doesn't have anything to do with old wives. The Nut Bible puts it this way, myths fit only for the godless and the gullible. Chapter 6, just skipping to the clues here. 6:9. But they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and hurtful lusts. 10. For the love of money is the root of all evil, which while some have coveted after, they have erred from the faith. This might be a clue. I don't know specifically and historically how you could connect covetousness with Gnosticism, but I think it is connected here. This would be number 8, coveting money. The letter to Titus seems to reinforce that this is a characteristic of the opponents, the vain talkers and the false teachers. Titus, I'll just quote you one verse because we're going to go to Titus later, but Titus 1:11 says, whose mouths must be stopped, who subvert whole houses, teaching things which they ought not, for filthy lucre's sake. And these are the same people, and he says, for filthy lucre's sake in Crete. And not long after this letter was written, Paul's dead, not too long after this, Peter writes back to these same congregations. And in 1 Peter, I'll just quote you a couple of verses here, where Peter also associates the false teaching with covetousness. 1 Peter 1:16 says, for we have not followed after cunningly devised fables, using the same terminology. And 2:1 says, but there were false prophets also among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you who privately bring in damnable heresies, even denying the Lord that bought them, and bring upon themselves swift destruction. He's talking about the same people. Verse 2, verse 3, Peter says, and through covetousness, they will with feigned words make merchandise of you. So I think the coveting of money is part of the problem. My guess is that these teachers of this higher spirituality are willing to teach you the secrets of the higher spirituality for a price. Sort of like the false teacher Simon of Samaria. So they are also making money off of their doctrine. And then verse 20. Yeah. O Timothy, keep that which is committed to your trust. Avoid profane and vain babblings, referring back to the similar clues we saw earlier, and oppositions of science falsely so-called. That word is gnosis. So this vain jangling, the man Hymenaeus, the different teachings about the resurrection, they are all tied together, and they are tied here in verse 20 to science, or gnosis, falsely so-called. I think it's very difficult to separate all the different problems in Ephesus to two groups. I don't think there are two groups. There's just one group who fits all these things. Now let's look at Titus over a couple pages. Titus might have been written earlier. We don't know. Paul has similar advice to Titus down in Crete. Now, there's nothing in Acts about a church in Crete. We only know from the first day of Pentecost that there were Cretans, at Jerusalem, and so there might have been a Jewish church in Crete, for 30 years. And from Acts 27 is the only other mention of Crete. Paul sailed through there on his way to Rome. The ship docked there briefly. And while Paul is in Rome and writes the letters to the other churches, there's no mention of Crete. But at his release, Paul's released from prison in Rome, and Timothy's at the same time, shortly after that, Paul sails to Crete. Does he sail there to raise up a church, to preach to the Gentiles, or does he sail there to deal with a church that already existed there? We don't know. The only thing we have about Crete is the letter of Titus, the letter to Titus. Well, we know that Titus was left in Crete to organize the church. He's also given instructions on ordaining elders. And we also know that he was there on temporary assignment. From chapter 3, we know that Paul intended to recall Titus from Crete and replace him with somebody else. Titus was supposed to join him in Nicopolis for the winter, just like Timothy was supposed to come later away from Ephesus. They were there on assignment to handle the problem, the crisis in leadership there. He says some similar things in Titus. Chapter 1, let's start in verse 9. Holding fast the faithful word as he has been taught, he's talking about a good leader, that he may be able by sound doctrine with doctrine both to exhort and to convince the gainsayers. Verse 10, for there are many unruly and vain talkers and deceivers, especially they of the circumcision. And this is very similar to number 3 back in 1 Timothy, the vain jangling. Whose mouths must be stopped, in verse 11, who subvert whole houses, as I read before. This is, again, a confirmation or another clue that these people did it for money. They coveted money. And verse 14 adds the other detail, not giving heed to Jewish fables. Back in Timothy, they were called fables, but here they're called Jewish fables, and commandments of men turned from the truth. So verses 10 and 14 tie all these clues together as being Jewish. You know, we have got circumcision, you've got Jewish fables. Clearly the problem in both Ephesus and Crete is Jews. It comes from the Jews. And Timothy speaks of teachers of the law. Titus speaks about later on in this book about strivings about the law. So we have Jewish fables, we have the law, we have circumcision. It all ties it to a Jewish source. But I would hasten to add, this is not Judaism. Judaism is not the problem. These people are ethnic Jews. But the Gnostics have their own meaning to circumcision. To them, circumcision is not related to the covenant with Abraham. Circumcision is the cutting away of the flesh, freedom from the flesh, freedom to ascend to the spiritual. They seek spiritual experience. I think it's an invaluable insight, at least it was to me, to learn that Gnosticism is a Jewish phenomenon, a sort of Jewish anti-Judaism. And thus, the trappings of the heresy, whenever we read of them, they often have a Jewish flavor because the Jewish Gnostics are reinterpreting the Old Testament. And this is how you can have Paul calling something Jewish a fable. Of course, he's not saying the Old Testament is a fable, but their interpretations of it are fables. Verse 16. They profess that they know God. This is not gnosis, but another word meaning that they perceive God. But in works they deny him, being abominable and disobedient. Disobedient, unbelieving, unfaithful, it's all the same concept in Greek. These people have left the faith, they are disobedient, they do not believe, and to every good work reprobate. Abominable and disobedient, this is not Judaism. Right? It's Jewish, but it's not Judaism. Their behavior is very bad. Then let's skip to chapter 3, verse 9. But avoid foolish questions and genealogies and contentions and strivings about the law, for they are unprofitable and vain. Is the law unprofitable and vain? Or is it their reinterpretations of the law? Very similar to 1 Timothy chapter 1 about the fables and endless genealogies and desiring to be teachers of the law. Verse 10, a man that is a heretic, this is the only occurrence of the word heretic, by the way, in the New Testament, comes from a Greek word meaning divisive. A man that is divisive after the first and second admonition reject, knowing that he that is such, verse 11, is subverted and sins, being condemned of himself. And I think the subject here may be the ordination of deacons and elders, which is a lot about what these two books are about. possibly because they're needing to replace elders who have turned against Paul. A man that is a heretic reject from being an elder. You know, the whole church here in Crete is a mystery as far as its origins, but I think it's pretty clear that Titus was written for the same reason that 1 Timothy was, and that was to combat this problem. This heresy has somehow come to Crete as well as it has to Ephesus. Anyway, the presence of a heresy in both Ephesus and Crete is very clear. The question is it all one problem, or is it not? Clearly, the part of the problem is Jewish. There's no denying the Jewish link. But the bulk of the problem can't fit Judaism. Judaism is not another doctrine about Christ. Judaism is not gnosis. It's not vain jangling, blasphemy, forbidding marriage, covetous, abominable, and disobedient. That's just not Judaism. There is no indication either in either of these letters that there's more than one problem. They all seem to be inextricably bound together as one. Something that teaches fables, endless genealogies, commandments of men, circumcision, and which reinterprets the law. There's just one alternative that I can think of. Pretty obvious to me. One set of teachers whose doctrines can fit all these characteristics, and that is Gnosticism. It is a spiritual knowledge with its own creation myth, and it reinterprets the meaning of Jesus Christ. It ascribes to him a different mission. As I said, it denies his human birth. It denies his human death. It denies his resurrection from that death. And this is the doctrine that has invaded Paul's churches from Corinth to Galatia, to Colossae, to Ephesus, and Crete. And this is the context, I think, that we need to understand some of the things that Paul wrote that are hard to be understood and that are commonly twisted. I think the clearer we understand the opposition, the clearer will be the writings of Paul.